Accession number 12502, Real One.
Sound. Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 1. Field Marshal, could you tell me if there was any long tradition of military service in your family?
No, I don't really think there was. I came from a very conservative father and a rather radical mother, and I won't say that on both sides, and funnily enough, particularly on hers, there haven't been the odd military men down the line, including, I think, a few generals. But I certainly wasn't what I was going to be described as from a military family. My father was in the First World War as a battery commander right the way through. My mother was not anxious that I should go into the army. She wanted me to be a doctor. But I was always very keen on military things, and of course I was brought up in the period of the 30s when war was looming very large. I was at school just before the war and in the early part of the war, and one really had no option, particularly as I was keen on the military side of life, but to go into the army just as soon as I can at the end of school.
Can you remember what it was particularly that attracted you to military things?
I can't actually really put my finger on that, but I was always fascinated, not just on the sort of more outward and visible signs like bands and uniforms and things which might appeal to small boys, but actually the whole question of tactics. I mean, I had, like many other children, a lot of toy soldiers, but I used them not just for purely parading, but I played with my elder brother sort of tactical games with rules of deploying infantry and cavalry, and I was fascinated with this. And, of course, when I was at school, I did take a great interest in the Corps, and I became an under-officer, of which I think there were only about two or three.
When you were playing your war games, did you use H.G. Wells' book Little Wars?
I can't actually remember that, but I do remember him writing on that. We certainly had a very definite code of rules and how near you had to be with your infantry, how near you had to be with your cavalry before you were posing a threat and what their attacking distance was and so on.
Could you say something about the Corps at Eton, the character of the training you received in it?
Yes, well, of course, it was very different. The Corps in 1939-40-41 was very different from the Corps at other times because, of course, it was more or less what you might call for real. And many of us, as well as being in the Corps, had ranks in the Home Guard, which had a very decided duty in trying to protect approaches to Windsor Castle and things like that. So it really was for real. So the rather casual approach and the sort of business that it was... really not very fashionable to be keen on the Corps, didn't apply in those particular years. And everybody did take it seriously, and the tactics and the field days and the exercises, everybody put their heart into. When my son was there in the 60s, of course, it was considered to be a slight joke, and people were rather aware of being too keen and things like that. But in our days, it was quite normal to be keen, and as I say, there were about three cadet officers, and I became one of them.
Who actually did the training?
We had permanent instructors who were retired soldiers, and then we got training teams down from the guards. We had an adjutant, of course, who was either guards or green jackets. And we occasionally got training teams. And our Certificate A, which was taken very seriously, was done by a team from the Household Cavalry. And I do remember a slightly amusing story, because I had my Certificate examination just after the Army had moved from fours to three. They used to form fours, and then they moved them into three sections. And I was told by this very elegant Household Cavalry officer, the most immaculate breeches and British warm and everything, he asked me to cite my platoon position. And I told him where I was going to put my three sections. And he then said, where would you like to put your fourth section? And I had to make a quick appreciation of whether he knew that the organisation had changed from four to three and was just trying me out, or whether he didn't know at all. And I came to the impression he didn't know at all, so I told him where I'd put my fourth section, and I got, I think, full marks.
Thinking back to it, was the tactical training in the Corps up to date, or did you find that it was somewhat obsolete when you got into
I think it was quite helpful. I think that a lot of the sort of low-level section tactics, section fire and movement, and platoon tactics was helpful later on, to some extent.
Was that taught mainly theoretically, or was it done out on the ground?
Oh, no, we had a lot of field days and exercises on Chobham Ridges and places like that. I mean, I still had a hell of a lot to learn when I went into the Army, and particularly when I was eventually commissioned. But, I think it got one thinking in the right direction.
Was there a great emphasis upon the appreciation of ground?
Yes, I suppose there was, really. I think that is perfectly true, and of course a lot of people at Eton took part in field sports and things like that, and it was a great thing that, you know, those did help you appreciate the contours and ground and so on like that. Yes, I think the covered line of approach, which is always a bit of a double-edged weapon, of course, because cover line approach may have actually been spotted by the enemy, who may have laid all sorts of unpleasant things in it. But yes, generally speaking, making the best use of ground was, I think, something that was brought out.
You said earlier that you knew you had no choice because war was imminent and then war had broken out. Can you remember the point at which you became convinced that a war was unavoidable?
Yes, I think perhaps I'm putting a little bit too much. Remember, I was 15 when the war started, so I mean one's powers of strategic and military appreciation wasn't too much. But I mean, all the news and everything else was building up. There was the Anschluss in Austria. There was the Munich Agreement, and then there was the Sudetenland, followed by the occupation of the rest of Czechoslovakia. And then, of course, our guarantee to Poland. And so it was pretty obvious by then that this was going to happen. And, of course, this has been slightly different from even the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War hasn't been an inexorable move before to war. Even at its height, there have been importance to have no uncertainty. But at the same time, it hasn't been this inexorable move. I mean, I don't think there was anybody who was at school or university, who was in the Territorial Army, who didn't think that war would be coming sooner or later, if not next year, the year after.
And were you able to get current and up-to-date information about developments in tactics and military techniques? I'm presuming as a war gamer you were still keenly interested in such things.
Yes, we read lots of papers, and there was a War Illustrated and things like that. And I remember once the war started, I had in my room a map with pins that I put in where the Germans had got to and where the Russians had got to and the Poles. That was right. But I don't think that one should put too much of a boy at that age, you know. I didn't really quite understand what exactly it all meant. My father had been pretty insistent that he never really talked much about the First War, although he went right through it and commanded a battery on the Western Front. And I remember my grandfather having some rather extraordinary stereo pictures of the trenches and things like that, which I saw when I went down to his grandfather's house. But there was very little talk about the war, and war was a terrible thing for my mother. I mean, she thought all war was a ghastly thing. And so, well, there wasn't very much talk about it. And it really wasn't till Munich that I got evacuated from my... it was the year before Munich, I think, we got evacuated when there was some scare. And then there was Munich. And then, of course, about that time, I went to my public school, Eton.
You were commissioned into the King's Royal Rifle Corps. How did that happen? Did you choose them, or did they choose you?
Well, I applied, and those days it was much more formal than it is now. I applied to be put on what was called the King's List, And then I was interviewed by the colonel commandants, who to me were very, very elderly gentlemen indeed, considerably younger, I may say, than I am now, but I thought they had one foot in the grave. And it's very interesting why I went into the... I had no family connections with either the King's Royal Rifle Corps and the Rifle Brigade, but I sensed then, by the people who were going from Eton into it, that it had something special about its approach to army discipline, to more formal army matters, its relationships with its other ranks and so on. And there was a sort of individuality which I particularly liked. And I sensed that in the people who'd gone into it before me. These were people I liked and respected. And although since then, of course, I've had a great admiration for the Brigade of Guards system and what they achieved, I knew instinctively it wasn't for me, and I knew that the green jacket approach to problems was for me.
Could you say a bit more about this special approach? What were its distinctive features?
Well, I think it was a certain informality, a lack of pomposity, going right back through to its traditional pedigree, really, of starting off as a irregular force in North America to fight the French and the Indians after Braddock's defeat, and then, of course, being picked up much later on by John Moore and the Light Division when they were used as skirmishers out in front and so on. So there was that informality. There was this great, I think, humanity in the question of discipline and understanding of the needs of the other ranks and what they... I mean, I think this is something which is now much more general in the army. But in those days, discipline was fairly formal and, you know, and I think it was less formal in the green jackets. And you didn't stamp your feet just for the sake of stamping your feet. Did everything in as economical and a practical way as possible, and you remembered that you were all part of the same family. It was your privilege to lead them, and that you wanted to treat them as far as possible as you would like to be treated yourself.
You were interviewed by the Colonel Commandant. Do you remember what sort of questions you were asked?
I think they were pretty simplistic. What school were you at? And I'd done reasonably well at school. I was captain of the cricket 11. I'd obviously been very keen on the Corps. I was a school prefect or the equivalent. And I was obviously keen and enthusiastic about the regiment, and they were kind enough to say that they would take me. I don't think it was terribly profound. I don't think I was, as far as I remember, as I would now ask them very in-depth questions about why I wanted to join. I mean, you didn't really have to ask in-depth questions because there was a war on and your country had to be defended and so on. So it was pretty simple, I think. But they were quite an interesting couple. One of them, Tavish Davidson, had been on Hague staff in the First War. Another one, Hereward Wake, was, I think, more well-known as a sporting man than he perhaps was as a military man, but he was a splendid, exuberant and courageous man. And these were the two who said, yes, you can go. But, of course, it was a long way, long haul from them, because I then joined as a rifleman, and I had a few 290 days in the ranks before I got a commission. And personally, I think I benefited enormously because I didn't go into a special Sandhurst company or a special brigade squad. I went in at an ordinary training centre. And I went in with boys from every class of society. And, you know, for the first time you found yourself drawing your palliasse, filling it with straw, lying it down there, Charlie poked at you if you were wearing fancy pajamas or anything like that, and suddenly you were in the real world outside. And I think this is And I then knew what it was like to be on the end of barmy orders and orders which appeared to have no sense to them. And I have never forgotten that. Ever since when I became a general, I still remembered what it was like to be a perfectly ordinary private soldier.
Where did you do this basic training?
I did it in York. Fulford Barracks, as it was called then, now it's called Imphal Barracks, York. And I was there for quite a long time. I then went to be a lance corporal at a training regiment in Retford, not the most congenial part of the world, Ramby Camp, Retford. And I was then sent also as a lance corporal to join a thing called 148 Training Brigade at Rootham in Kent, where we were under canvas, and I became a member of the Sherwood Foresters temporarily. I was attached to them, and we did our motorcycle training, our wireless training, our fitness training, going up and down the escarpment, and it's mostly a motor transport and signals that we did. And then I came back to the officer cadet training unit, which was in York as well. Because Sandhurst, of course, had shut and became later, when it reopened, the Royal Armoured Corps, OCCHU, and so I didn't go there.
Can you remember much about the syllabus of basic training as a rifleman?
Yes, it was pretty, in those days it was pretty, real basic is the good word for it. I mean, there was an awful lot of interior economies, cleaning, laying out your kit. There was a great deal of drill, there was a lot of physical training, a certain amount of route marching to toughen you up, and firing on the ranges. Very little, if any, tactics that I can remember in the basic training.
Basic skills?
Yeah.
Presumably you were already quite fit, having been at school and active in the corps.
Yes, Rootham made us extremely fit. I mean, we went on real, what the army would call, bashes there. And every morning, I don't know whether you know Rootham, it's probably you don't, but it's on the way down to Maidstone, and there's this big escarpment, which is now has marvellous executive houses all over it. But the camp was on the top, and every morning the morning PT was to run down the hill and run up again. So, you know, we were really fit then.
When you did route marches, can you remember what sort of distances you covered?
Well, I don't think they were very different from, I mean, there was the 10-mile march, and then there was the 2-mile run, I seem to remember, when you had to run the whole way to do it in the time. Those were the two main things that we did. And then, of course, later on, when I became an officer, we went on to battle schools and things, but that's a different question.
Did you have march and shoot competitions where you had to combine the two basic infantry skills?
I think that I don't think the 10-mile one did, but I think the 2-mile one ended on the range. I think you did have to do something like that. I think that this is something that's developed over the years. Remember, this was getting on for 50 years ago. I think it had developed since then. I mean, I think you kept them more or less in separate compartments.
Did they pay a great deal of attention to shooting?
Did the regiment? Oh, it's tremendous. Tremendous attention to shooting. I mean, this was its big thing before the war. Again, from its historical pedigree, when, of course, they had the rifle, when other people still had the musket, and when they had to shoot, wasn't, you know, you had to still load it from the other end, but you still had a much more accurate, and you could hit people at hundreds of yards instead of tens of yards, which is what they had with the musket.
In the basic training phase, did you see much of the officers, or was it mainly the NCOs who did
Mainly the NCOs. Mainly the NCOs, and I'll just tell you this, because something which has struck in my mind all the way through my service, certainly at the primary training, I mean, there was obviously a company commander, but the man who was God was our platoon sergeant. There was no doubt about that. And I had a... talking about not so ballistilly orders, but talking about the world is an unfair world. And the sooner everybody realises it, the better. I remember that one day we had recreational training. So we all got out, you see. And I was actually quite a good cricketer. And the platoon sergeant said, right, anyone's name begin with A? Anyone's name begin with B? So I said, yes, Sergeant, Bramble's on. Right, Bramble, you bat number 11. So somebody piped up and said, Sergeant, do you know Bramble's ready or wrong? I don't care if he's a great cricketer. I said he'll bat number 11, and bat number 11 he will, he said. So that was a very good lesson that I learned. But when I went down to Rootham, there was an officer in the Sherwood Foresters who we hadn't seen a great deal of. And one day, in November, very nasty weather and tents, he suddenly said to the platoon sergeant, get all the platoon together. So we were all assembled, and he said, look, there's been a great battle in the desert at a place called Alamein. And he said, I thought you'd all like to know what happened. And there, with all the stuff that he could assemble from papers and so on, and he'd made a map and had a blackboard, and he explained how the battle had gone and what Rommel had done and what Montgomery had done. And I thought to myself, my goodness, this man thinks we're worth taking all this trouble over. And I thought that this taught me a lesson about man management, which I've remembered. I wonder what's happened to the platoon commander now.
Did you find the Sherwood Foresters had a different atmosphere when you were in that?
Oh, yes, I think at Rootham we were, yes, a little bit. I mean, the thing was more what I call, for want of another term, red coat.
Bit stiffer.
Yeah, a bit more formal. Well, you know, but it was all right. That was good for me too. I mean, I didn't. But the green jacket system has its, as well as its great strengths and advantages, has its disadvantages if you are not, if the officers are not, haven't the personality to handle, they would be far better to go back to the more formal system where you can't make quite so many mistakes. And so I didn't resent doing this at all, but it was slightly different, I think.
Now, you mentioned you got trained in motor.
Yes, motorcycle, motor trucks, yes.
Was this in driving and maintenance?
Yes, driving and maintenance, D&M, Jackner, driving and maintenance, motorcycle, we all had to ride. I mean, this is where I first got a driving licence. And we were taught to drive because, I mean, I was only 18 and I hadn't actually, I mean, I might have done, driven a family car, but I hadn't actually by that time. So that was when my licence started. And then we drove motorcycles all over these cross-country courses.
And was that all done by Sherwood Foresters?
Well, there was the brigade, the Sherwood Foresters, the Berkshires, the Royal Berkshires, and there was another battalion, and I don't know, formed the instructors for the whole of this, people who were later to become officers.
And then you mentioned wireless as well.
Oh, that's right. Yes, wireless radio, yeah. Very, I mean, those days, I mean, I suppose if you had to put your finger on the biggest change of warfare, you would put communications. I mean, in those days, few of the sets worked all the time, and now they more or less all do work all the time. And the reason why battles like the Arnhem Bridge were so disastrous is that the idea of communicating over 10 miles was quite out of the question, and the whole netting and tuning points was complicated. They were very heavy. They had batteries, which of course ran out very, very quickly. It wasn't a very exact science in those days. The motor battalions, which the Green Jackets were probably better at it than anybody else because they concentrated on this.
As a matter of necessity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you also trained in other means of signalling, such as line?
Yes, I suppose we had a certain amount on line. I remember using line a great deal in the battle in Belgium and Holland, later in Northwest Europe. Certainly line was run out to our platoons and things like that, and the old telephone at the end of it as being a method of communication. Yes, line was a very principal part of the signal platoon.
Could you tell me how they trained you to be an officer when you got out to York?
Yes, well, then when we became that was a much more interesting affair, of course, because we got out into the field very much more. I mean, we had many, many exercises out, and of course, wonderful training area on the Yorkshire Moors, crossing rivers and so on. I mean, this was quite climbing towers and obstacle courses, assault courses, tactical training, lectures on tactics and so on. This was a good course, and all our instructors, or most of our instructors, are people who'd had actual battle experience and had come back from the desert or Sicily or Italy or something like that.
When you did your exercises, did you make a lot of use of tutes, or were they exercises in which you were opposed by other members of the same course? Or did you have actual soldiers?
No, I think toots, of course. Since then, I've got very interested in training in all my life, and of course the toot. The Germans used to run their toots so much more realistically than we ran ours. Ours tended to be sort of take your sandwiches and shooting sticks and look at the ground. They did their toot. If they had to do a recce, they had to crawl up and do it up the ground. They did it in real time. They had so long to prepare their orders and everything else. And I think this is much more can be made of the toot. And, of course, you can always graft on some, in big tactical exercises or command post exercises, you can always graft on some troops to give the momentum, the proper tempo. I mean, for instance, if during the toot you have to cross a river, well, then you actually have the troops to build a bridge and so on. So a lot could be made of it. Yes, we used toots. I think they were fairly, perhaps unimaginatively done in those days, but they brought out the principles. And the more you can think about tactics. I do know that when I went into battle, and I did have a step, which I'm coming to in between my octu. When I went into battle and I was first brought under fire, I certainly wasn't nonplussed about what I ought to do. It wasn't always easy to do it, but I knew what I ought to do. I had a very good idea. My training had been quite good.
Was the tactical training mainly in the form of battle drills?
Well, they were just coming. Battle drill was just coming in, and it had been invented by some very brilliant non-military chaps who were stockbrokers or something in the city, who were in the Royal Fusiliers. And they invented this thing. I mean, the logic was, look, close order drill, which the army's been doing, was actually based on what the army actually did in battle, that they formed ready to resist the cavalry in squares, or they opened out to meet the infantry or whatever. Surely, instead of flogging around in threes, move to the right in column of route and all the rest of it, we ought to develop a drill which would be actually useful on the modern battlefield. And so they actually did this, took it, I think, rather slavishly, but they did it so that you did the fire and movement, right flanking, Bren group there, and all the rest of it, you did this as an actual drill movement. And every single thing was a drill movement, and you had to try and get the same precision. And so that was one of the things. But it was made quite clear, of course, that this was only the basis. What really mattered was applying the principles of this drill movement to the actual ground. And you had to do it a bit differently. But you see, after I had been commissioned, I went to a thing called the Motor Training Battalion at Strensel, just outside York. And I was given straight away the demonstration platoon, which was a wonderful thing for the young officer to have. So I had to do all the demonstrations and so forth. That perfected my tactics. And then I was given the potential officer platoon, and I trained a lot of aspiring officers. So again, that was quite a key thing. And then, of course, when I was heard marvellously that I was going to an operational battalion, the 2nd Battalion, which had just come back from Italy for the 2nd Front, which was a marvellous opportunity, I was sent on the War Office Battle School, I think it was called School of Infantry. Exciting place indeed. And everything was done with live ammunition, artillery live ammunition, small arms live. You carried all the equipment. And officers and other ranks were all put together in the same platoon. So one day you might find yourself commanding and having a couple of majors under you, and another time you might be number two on the Bren gun. But it was a very hard course.
This was then the first time you did come under fire, even though it was not hostile.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, when I was a demonstration platoon commander, I used to do demonstrations in which people had to crawl under fire and things like that, but of course they were all very linked up.
On fixed line.
Yes. And of course I did have a baptism of fire, because through no fault of mine or anybody's, I'd had my platoon out on the grenade range, and a chap went mad and threw the grenade, instead of forward, sideways, and it went right along the, over the bay where my sergeant was, hit the roof of the shelter where the people were waiting to come forward, and dropped down inside. I mean, there was nothing anybody could do about it except trying to get them to get out of the shelter. And I think I found myself as a young officer with two killed and several wounded out in the middle of nowhere. So I had a really quite a quick baptism. And afterwards, the range was condemned, but it was a good experience to suddenly find yourself having to cope.
Did you know this soldier well, the one who went mad?
Well, he didn't actually go mad. I mean, he didn't go mad in the sense. Something went wrong with his coordination.
He just let
I mean, you know, I was with him and the